From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. President Barack Obama this week told the Environmental Protection Agency to reconsider a policy that says states cannot increase their own tailpipe emissions standards. California and more than a dozen other states were barred from adjusting stricter emission standards under the Bush administration. The argument was higher fuel efficiency standards would be too expensive for the car industry. California's goal is to reduce the carbon dioxide emissions from cars and light trucks by 30% by 2016. Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California is leading the push on Capitol Hill to get the EPA to allow that state to enforce its own emission rules. Senator Boxer, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks for having me.
You call President Obama's comments on this issue, quote, music to your ears. I suppose it would be the first positive sign that you've gotten on this in the years since the Bush White House rejected the idea of dual standards for California and the rest of the nation.
Well, I think what's broadly misunderstood is we've always had dual standards. Since the Clean Air Act was written, and California has gotten 50 waivers because the whole notion was that the federal standard would be, you know, the basic standard, but if states wanted to do more, California could take the lead and others could follow. So this was the first time in 50 years that we have not been granted a waiver. So it was very shocking.
The new head of the EPA, Lisa Jackson, says that she'll look at this and quickly. How confident are you now that this is going to happen and how soon?
Well, she's definitely going to look at it right away because the president announced that he was asking her to do so. She also committed to us that she would. And I'm very confident because if science is to prevail, we're going to get the waiver. The scientists at EPA said that EPA had no leg to stand on in terms of turning down a waiver so that we could have cleaner cars and lessen global warming in our state. Our state is really vulnerable to global warming with our old forests and our coastlines and all the problems that we have, so many people, so many cars. So we're ready to go. And the whole notion is that the federal government shouldn't stand in the way of progress here.
Senator Boxer, is it your intention that stricter standards adopted in California eventually become the standard for the rest of the country?
Well, actually, 19 states have already embraced it, so we know that half of the country is already going to embrace it. As far as the other states, I don't know, but clearly when half of the country has embraced our standards, we're going to see technology step up to the plate because they have this big market.
Automakers, as you know, argue that the new standards would burden an already badly crippled industry. Legitimate or not legitimate?
They've got legitimate problems with this economy, as do, you know, most people today. But the fact is, one of the reasons they're in so much trouble is they abandon the fuel-efficient market to the Japanese and others. It's a huge mistake on their part. And if they keep thinking in the old ways, they're not going to survive. Because I could tell you, I don't see Barack Obama or the Congress giving them funds, endless funds, if they don't step up to the plate. Now, they could produce energy-efficient cars that meet a very strong standard at less than the price of a Hummer. So let's see them do it.
Senator, you know, a lot of Californians care about air quality because most days here in Southern California, you can actually see the air because of the emissions.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is there enough support among people here in this state to be willing to pay to have better air?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no question that people understand one of the greatest costs to us now comes from health conditions that arise from polluted air, whether it's asthma, heart difficulties, and so on. We've actually quantified this. Thousands of people die because of dirty air. So, yes, I think Californians are very proud of our record in terms of stepping up to the plate for clean air, clean water, and we've got a long way to go. So this is one area where I think we are united. But again, it's not just California. It's 19 other states, and it's beyond the air we breathe. It's also the amount of carbon that is in the air, in the atmosphere, in the form of greenhouse gases, which everyone who's got a heartbeat and a pulse knows is weighing on us greatly, because if we have this rise in temperatures over time, life as we know it just won't exist anymore. There'll be horrible droughts and diseases, and we're really headed in that direction. So this move to clean up cars is not only about the air we breathe, but it's also the quality of life that we'll have in the future if we have to face the ravages of global warming.
One last question, Senator, and I thank you for your time.
Sure.
If you're successful with this, when should we expect to see a change in the environment, and how much of a change might that be?
Well, you know, to quantify what we'll see, I will tell you this. As California and the 19 other states move forward, we're going to see cars on the road that get, you know, 40, 50 miles to the gallon. We're going to see electric cars on the road. That's going to have an impact right away on our air. It's going to have an impact in our pocketbooks. So I think in the next several years, we'll start to see the rewards from that. And we'll also see a lot of green jobs created. And that's going to be very important as we suffer through this deep recession.
Senator, thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was California Democrat Senator Barbara Boxer. She is the chairwoman of the Senate Environmental and Public Works Committee. Now we turn to California's Attorney General Jerry Brown, who sued the Environmental Protection Agency for denying his state the individual right to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from cars. Jerry Brown, welcome to News and Notes.
Well, thank you.
How do these latest developments change things?
Pardon me?
How do these latest developments actually change things with regard to cleaning up?
Well, they change everything because now, with President Obama, the EPA will react based on honest science and will, in all probability, give California the permission to go ahead and impose its tailpipe emissions.
Now, let's clear something up.
That's tailpipe emission standards.
Let's clear something up, Jerry, that Senator Boxer made reference to. California already has a different standard for auto emissions than the rest of the nation, but this waiver, which the former president blocked, would now allow the state to strengthen it. Is that correct?
No. What the deal is this. Since the time of Nixon, California has had a separate authority to impose vehicle tailpipe emissions.
Let me ask you about the significance of this and the issue that the automakers have made, that the cost is going to be prohibitive for them and for consumers. Is that a legitimate argument in your view?
No, but I do think there are going to be some costs, and maybe serious costs. But with the billions that the car companies need now, there ought to be a way to find some middle ground here to help them do what they need to do. They have spent 20 years or longer avoiding making efficient cars and instead opting for power and luxury. Now they got to come back into the real world and become competitive, and I think they can do it.
Here's one last question for you. Governor Schwarzenegger has been a proponent of cleaning up the environment, but he has termed out you are a clean air advocate. Are you going to make this an issue, part of your run for the governor's seat in 2010?
Well, if I do run for governor and no final decision has been made, I would certainly emphasize the importance of the environment and protecting our air in particular and advancing the cause of combating global warming. All those things are very important to me.
How soon a decision can we expect from you, Governor?
I got a full-time job as Attorney General, and I'm in no hurry to get into another campaign.
I appreciate it, Jerry Brown. Thank you very much.
Okay, great.
California Attorney General Jerry Brown. He joined us by phone from his office in Oakland. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. From gritty streets of Baltimore to the seedy underbelly of Los Angeles, few literary genres capture the imagination better than crime fiction. There are crooks, private eyes, and of course, some dames as well. Crime fiction brings the bad guys to our backyards, and today, as part of our ongoing series on crime, we bring you the finest in African-American crime writers. Paula Woods joins us now to start off this conversation. We'll be joined by some others in just a moment. She's the author of the Charlotte Justice Mystery Series and the editor of Spook, Spies, and Private Eyes, an anthology of African-American crime fiction. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Tony.
It's nice to have you here.
Thanks.
Crime fiction is often about death and the seedy underbelly of society, and your book, Spook, Spies, and Private Eyes, gives a cross-section of African-American crime fiction writers. In what way would you say, Paula, that African-American crime fiction writers make the genre their own?
I think one of the things that I always admired about what people like Walter Mosley, Gar Haywood, Gary Phillips and others do is that they really tell us what it's like to live in Black America. When crime fiction, when Black crime fiction was first written, going back to 1900, it was always about a different part of society that we didn't see. And so for African-American readers, it was seeing yourself validated through the culture. It wasn't necessarily always about the crime. It was also about the culture. And for whites, it was like a little peek under the kimono. You know, you got to see Harlem in Rudolph Fisher, or you got to see Walter Mosley's 1940s L.A., or you got to see Charlotte Justice's Los Angeles in the 90s. So it was always something different and a different aspect of life that we didn't see before.
Yeah, but how did it change from, say, a Chester Himes to a Mosley to to Gar, Anthony Haywood? How has it changed, that storytelling and looking under the cover, so to speak?
Well, you know, I think Chester Himes was as much caricature in some regards as it was a look at the culture. Walter Mosley, when his books came out in the early 90s, were much more inside Black culture from a reality standpoint. And I think the same is true of Gar. I think the early writers were much more stylized. And I think the current crop of writers are much more realistic.
Well, let's talk to some of those current crop of writers who are joining us in the studio. With us right now, we're joined by Gar Anthony Haywood. He is the Seamus Award-winning author of the Aaron Gunner series, and Gary Phillips, who writes and edits crime and mystery stories. His latest graphic novel, High Rollers, is about an L.A. gangster. Gentlemen, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Tony.
Gar, let me start with you. There are many different forms of writing out there. You chose crime. What kind of research do you do before you start writing?
It depends on the story, Tony, of course. I try to do as much as is necessary to make the story believable, as opposed to quote-unquote realistic. You know, I was fortunate enough to start writing in the age of the Internet, where it's a relatively simple thing to get on the net and Google something and come up with a ton of material. You know, for my protagonist, Aaron Gunner specifically, there isn't a whole lot of research necessary other than all the reading I've done within the genre and my own personal experience, my life experiences. Okay. You know, I'm not one of those writers that, you know, will say that my characters are not in some way similar to myself. A lot of Gunner's attitudes and such come from my own. And so in that respect, research doesn't really come into the equation very much. Gunner is myself in another profession, and you know, I try not to overplay research too much, but I definitely think that you have to do enough so that the reader believes what he's reading.
It has some credibility, obviously. Gary, you grew up in South Los Angeles, and your graphic novels take place here in the City of Angels. What makes this such a good place for crime noir?
Well, I guess the old adage is that L.A. in particular is a place where people come to reinvent themselves for various reasons, for good and for ill. And of course, it's prickling below the surface of that, or it's prickling into their lives before they got here, and their lives they've now kind of manufactured for themselves while they're here. that leads to this kind of rich soil, I think it is, to tell these crime and mystery stories. I write both novels and comic books and graphic novels, so I get to play with the form a lot, and it's really great for me to kind of go back and forth between prose and being able to tell stories with words and pictures.
Well, Paula, is there such a thing as a geography to the culture of writing black crime fiction?
Well, there are many geographies, because if you think about some of the writers, they wrote about the black underclass. And so there's that geography. In other writers' work, in Stephen L. Carter, for example, or in the Charlotte Justice series, they write about the black elite. So the geography can be class. It can be geography like L.A. I mean, L.A. is blessed, I think, to have the greatest concentration of black crime writers anywhere in the country. I don't know if you guys have thought about that, but, you know, there are more of us here than anywhere else.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? Have you guys thought about that? Why is that? And not just because the weather's better either, right?
That might have something to do with it, Tony.
I don't know. Gary, you want to take that one?
I don't know, because I tell you what, I can't write when it's really too cold. I'm going to tell you that now. or I'm worried about paying the heating bill. But maybe it does, you know, following this thread of, well, partly, of course, we know that this is where the movies are. So, of course, people are attracted to that, and they come here for that. I was actually, funny enough, I was just thinking as people were talking, it's interesting to note that there's a couple of antecedents, I suppose they are, ancestors to where we're at today. And in particular, I was thinking of Joe Nazel. Joe Nazel was who passed, I guess, about a year and a half or 2 years ago.
Yeah,
and
Joe was one of my teachers.
There we go. Yeah. There we go. And a lot of people probably haven't heard of Joe Nazel because, as we know, he wrote all of his work were paperback originals for a small Holloway house here in which still exists here in town. But funny enough, I was thinking of his work particularly because they were crime novels and they were set in the 70s. Here in Los Angeles, Street Wars, The Wolves, etc. So there is a kind of interesting, ancestry there to like the black crime writing of today.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Joe Nazel was also a journalist.
That's correct.
Yes,
so
he was.
He was a colleague of mine as well.
Yeah.
Let me ask: Do you think that publishers have more of an appetite, Gar, for these kinds of books from black authors than perhaps other types of books written by blacks?
That hasn't been my experience, Tony. not recently, anyway.
Let me show you my 7-book contract.
That's
right.
Okay. And Maestro from Haywood, tell him we're not here.
No, I think that the way that publishing is changing, and not for the better, lately, that probably authors of color, within or without genre, are feeling the crunch probably more than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I just received a rejection for the manuscript that my agent is presently trying to sell and has been trying to sell for going on 2 years. And this rejection letter or email was very, very positive about what they liked about the book. They seemed to love everything about it, but the note of the rejection was essentially that the main character's life experience was not universal enough for the size of the audience that they would want to attract.
So what does that mean,
the book.
Paula? How do you interpret
well,
that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I find in publishing that when it comes to publishing in African Americans, there's always the one. So when Bill Clinton said that Walter Mosley was one of his favorite writers, he became the one.
That was it.
And when you talk about black literary fiction, Toni Morrison is the one. And I think publishing tends to do that. And we had a day, there was a time in African American fiction in general that there were multiple voices. But as the economy gets more and more compressed, you find that they're looking for, well, who's the one that's going to sell the most books? And so it tends to diminish the number of opportunities for writers. And then you have other things that come in. I think, like right now, there's this preoccupation with Indian culture. So you'll find a lot of Indian writers who publishers, New York-based publishers, are all excited about because, like, they're the new ones. Mm. That's okay. The one we don't know. It's the exotic. And I think whether our experiences are universal enough or exotic enough, there's always a line you're trying to walk with other people who are evaluating whether what you're writing about is authentic enough or or universal enough.
Well, let's talk about the actual genre itself, the book, the storyline, the protagonist, the conflict, things like that. For people who like that type of book, and I'm hands up, I'm one. You get into a good crime novel, and you just can't put it down. You carry it with you everywhere you go, mm-hmm. in the purse, in the car, in your pocket. And any time you sit down and you catch 2 or 3 minutes, you're going to flip through a few pages.
Right.
What is it about that style, Gary, of writing? What is it that you put in there that keeps readers turning the page?
Well, of course, that's what every writer hopes for, that the reader will, as you said, Tony, not put that book down and be absorbed by it and be carried away in that story. But I think it always gets back to, in any kind of writing, in the genre or outside of the genre, it's always about the characters. It really is. It really gets down to, I think, the psychology of the people that you, these two-dimensional or three-dimensional, hopefully, characters that you try to make live on the page, that they come to life for you, and hopefully they come to life for the reader. Now, obviously, also crime novels in particular, they're always about the weird twists and turns of the crime, particularly in the noir bent. That is to say, in a noir novel, you know that things are not what they seem. Mm-hmm. You also know that these characters are out for themselves. Somebody's going to backstab or betray somebody else. And I think, you know, it's partly, it just sort of gets to that part of us in human nature. I think you kind of wait for that to happen. You wait for that to come. And the trick is to make it fresh, to make it seem kind of new and exciting. Because in the end, and maybe it was Raymond Chandler who said this, I'm not sure who said it. It might have even been Shakespeare. But there's really only 6 or 7 plots.
Mm-hmm. And now, does it matter in terms of, A, writing the story, B, marketing the story, whether the protagonist in a crime novel is male or female, Gar?
Certainly not at this point. I mean, once upon a time, mm-hmm. of course, there probably was a prejudice toward the male character, but that doesn't exist anymore. If anything, it's completely the reverse. But okay. I agree completely with what Gary said, that the draw of a book, almost any type of book, is in the character. If you believe these people and if they seem three-dimensional to you and their experiences are interesting and fascinating in some way, you know, that's what's going to keep someone reading. I think the other thing, too, specific to the mystery or crime genre, and I've said this many times in answering this particular question, I think that the attraction of the mystery novel is that typically the bad guys don't get away. The bad guys get what's coming to them. So, for instance, if I were to feature Bernard Madoff in the next book,
we know how that would end.
He's dead by page 3.
Okay. Then it's just about finding the money.
Yeah. Let me ask you, because Paula's eyebrows seem to go up on the issue of the gender protagonist. Hmm. At the statement that you made, that you think that perhaps it's reversed now, do you see it that way?
Yes and no. I can think of isolated writers, Patricia Cornwall or Sue Grafton, mm-hmm. who have a huge following for their female protagonists. But I find, in general, I think it's the male protagonists that are moving the plots. Because if the guy is interesting enough, the men are going to want to read him. And if he's sexy enough, the women want to read him, too.
Also, there's something to that, because I think that the stereotype that people who read these kinds of books, myself included, you're looking for a good storyline, but mm-hmm. you're also looking for some violence, and
right.
you're looking for
right.
some sex.
Right, absolutely.
Is that not right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I have a formula chart right above my computer.
Well, you know, it's funny. When I wrote the first Charlotte Justice book, Inner City Blues, there's the sex scene in it. And frankly, as I was writing, I was like, I got to get through all this plot. And, you know, I got to get some sex in here. I got to have some sex in this book. And so I wrote the chapter and then wrote my way up to it. Today, still, I have people say, you know, there was that one part of that book that I just really liked. And when you go write that again?
We know what part that was.
Yeah.
Let me bring the conversation to a close with this question. Do you read other crime writers? And if you do, is there a danger in doing that as a writer yourself? Mm. Gary.
Yeah. Well, the danger is you don't want to outrightly or overtly steal somebody else's plot, particularly if they're a friend of yours, because you're going to invariably see them and they're going to be pissed off about that.
You're right.
My normal routine is that if I'm in the middle of a book or I'm in the middle of writing a comic book script or just a general script, I will avoid reading anybody any kind of crime or mystery story because I don't want to crib from it. I don't consciously crib from it. But of course, invariably, all this stuff is like bubbling up in your head. I mean, one of my favorites, and you wouldn't necessarily see it in my work, was a crime writer or mystery writer named Ross McDonald, who wrote very evocative stories, but very minimal on violence and sex in his stories, but really about the inward journey of his characters. He was very influenced by sort of Freudian things, and it was very plays out a lot in his books. But so invariably, I will probably return to his work as a kind of anchor and a kind of stationing point. But I will consciously, as I said, sort of avoid reading the people that I know or books that are in circulation now until I've finished. And then, of course, I'll take some relaxation time.
Really quickly, Garv, I've got about 10 seconds for you to answer this.
I will say I agree with Gary completely, but I will say that if you're conscious of reading only the best, then if it has an influence on your writing, it's all for the good. There's nothing wrong with that. And by the way, you talked about Bill Clinton being a big fan of Walter Moses. I just wanted to announce officially on NPR today that I have dibs on 44.
That's what you think.
All right. Unfortunately, our time is up. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate all of you coming in. We'd like to have you come back. Bring books with you. When you come back.
Absolutely.
Gar Anthony Haywood is the author of the Aaron Gunner series. Gary Phillips writes and edits crime and mystery stories. His latest graphic novel is High Rollers. And Paula Woods is the author of the Charlotte Justice series. All three of them join me here in the studios of NPR West. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. From Super Bowl Sunday to racy high school cheerleader dance routines to the revolving top of college basketball, it's time for sports. And there's a lot to talk about on today's Sports Bloggers Roundtable. Joining us are Chad Brown of alphablogsports.blogspot.com and Erica Hernandez, who is the features editor for Rego magazine. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello. Well, the big day in football finally here, Super Bowl Sunday, could be one for the history books from a couple of perspectives. While the Pittsburgh Steelers are going for their record 6th franchise Super Bowl trophy, the Arizona Cardinals are making their Super Bowl debut. For Arizona, Chad, just being there is historic in and of itself. After all, they've been organizationally challenged, fan challenged, player challenged, coach challenged, but not this year.
No, you're absolutely right. This is unbelievable. If you had said at the beginning of the season or this time last year, the Arizona Cardinals would be representing the NFC in the Super Bowl, nobody would believe you. But having said that, since they got whipped in New England, they've played like they deserve to be here. They're forcing turnovers. Larry Fitzgerald has been a beast. And Kurt Warner, he's now taking a team that relocated to St. Louis and the team that relocated from St. Louis to the Super Bowl. It's unbelievable.
Absolutely it is. You know, Erica, this isn't Cardinals quarterback Kurt Warner's first Super Bowl, as we just said, which is good for the Cardinals, of course. He's a former league and Super Bowl MVP. A good performance here, a win, for example. He's back in the hunt for the Hall of Fame, isn't he?
Yes, he is. I think just with the win over the Eagles, definitely people started talking. They were talking all along. But now if he does leave with a ring, I think guarantees him a spot in the Hall of Fame.
I think you're right about that. Hey, Chad, the Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger has been there as well as a winning Super Bowl quarterback. His health, though, was an issue because of the concussion he got in the last regular season game. But which one of these guys would you rather have starting for you on Sunday, Ben or Kurt?
It's a tough one. In an ideal world, I'd take either or, but I'd give Kurt Warner the slight edge, even though I'm picking the Steelers, just because he's been there before and performed well before. Ben, by his own admission, while he has played well in this postseason, his last Super Bowl trip, he did not do well by his own admission. But, you know, you wipe the slate clean. He's 2 years removed from that performance. He can do well. But Kurt has just been unbelievable. It's not even – obviously the long throws to Larry Fitzgerald or Anquan Boldin, but even the little things like the third down pass against Atlanta that sealed the game, I thought that was unbelievable. And the screen and the shovel and the screen pass for the touchdown against the game winning touchdown against the Eagles when they had been in a drought. I mean, this guy has really seen everything before. The flip side is he'll be going up against Dick LeBeau, who has been around Dick LeBeau's defense, and he's been around as long as the National Football League has been around, I believe.
That's true. It's going to be a real test for him. Who do you like as a quarterback better, Erica?
I would say right now at this moment it would have to be Kurt Warner for the same reasons that Chad's given.
Really?
Because
he does seem to be a little bit on – have momentum going his way, but Steel Curtain could stop that. We'll find out. Speaking of the Steelers, by the way, Chad, their coach Mike Tomlin may also be making history if Pittsburgh wins. He would become only the second black head coach to ever win a Super Bowl, Tony Dungy the first. Ironically, though, Tomlin was hired by the Rooney family, which owns the team. They're the folks who created the so-called Rooney Rule, under which NFL teams must at least interview minorities for vacant head coaching jobs. Talk about paying off.
No, absolutely. And actually, it's interesting. He actually wasn't the quote-unquote Rooney candidate for the Steelers. They had interviewed Ron Rivera, the Chicago Bears defensive coordinator at the time. But thanks to the Rooney Rule expanding the pool of candidates, they took a look at Tomlin. They had him in for an interview. He blew them away, and they had him in again. So he definitely has made use of that, both in terms of getting in and also in terms of staying. And for me personally, I think the Rooney Rule has been good because it not only expands the pool of candidates not only on a racial level, but even as far as the age level, just expanding the candidates you might not have normally looked at. So now when they're being hired and fired, there's not as much outcry as it was when there were fewer African-American coaches, and people might have been wondering, well, why is he being fired? Why is he not? Now it's more of an even field. I would like to see the rule expanded more to front office positions as well, considering the jobs that guys like Ozzie Newsome and Jerry Reese have done in constructing championship teams.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's an interesting point. You know, something else we should quickly mention before we move to our next topic is this. Everybody loves the Super Bowl, right, Erica?
Yes.
Right. And at least they used to. I mean, I'm not hearing a lot of talk. Check that. I'm hearing talk, but I'm not hearing a lot of excitement about this one outside perhaps of Pittsburgh or Arizona. NBC is back as the TV host for the game for the first time in a long time. That means John Madden will be back on the mic, and that's usually entertaining. But I don't know, the buzz just is not there, is it?
I don't think it is, but I think with this whole Kurt Warner talk and just the whole Manning and Warner thing, I think it's actually sparked it a little bit.
Do you think so?
I think so.
Chad, do you think so?
I would agree to a sense. I think another thing you have to look at, remember last year at this time, you had the New England Patriots that were going for 18-0, and you have the New York Giants who were on a tear and also representing two of the bigger media markets, bigger fan bases. So while the Steelers, you know, they're going to pack and travel everywhere, the Cardinals, I mean, with no disrespect to their fans, are kind of like, really? Wow, we going to the Super Bowl? Okay. So that could feed into it as well.
Yeah, you're probably right. Plus, there's no real bad boys. You know, nobody's That's misbehaving. True. Nobody's been in jail or drunk, accidents, any of that sort of stuff. It's terrible to say that, but that is part of what makes the storylines so interesting when you have a Dallas and some other.
Yeah, and they didn't even make the playoffs.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So these are good guys. Presumably we'll find out what happens on the court. All right, let's talk about another rule in sports that has a lot of folks hot under the collar in the state of Texas and beyond. You might call it the mercy rule, Erica, where in youth sports, the idea is not to embarrass a team that's getting their butts kicked. Here's what happened at a high school girls basketball game in Dallas. The Covenant School slaughtered the Dallas Academy 100-0. That's right, I said 100-0.
Ouch.
Then officials from Covenant later apologized, offered to forfeit the game, and then fired their basketball coach, calling the team's behavior on the court embarrassing and shameful. And I should add, I guess, the losing team's players were learning disabled. Erica, there's a lot to talk about with this. What was your initial thought when you heard about this?
Well, everything I read was coming from the Covenant perspective. I never heard any of the girls from the Dallas girls actually complain or feel any type of embarrassment because they lost. They actually kept going. I think in the fourth quarter they held them to 12 points. So obviously they were still in it too. You know, even if it just they held their heads up high and they continued, they didn't want to quit. So I think that mercy rule shouldn't have had any effect in there. As far as I think there was one of the coaches or one of the kids' moms said that it just felt like it was too like a layup drill and they were embarrassing Covenant's kids were just cheering them on. But at the same time, the Dallas girls weren't complaining. They went out there and they kept going.
They did the best that they could. Well, you know, Chad, the team that lost, as I said, was made up of students with learning disabilities. They haven't won a game in 4+ years. Should they even be in a league where they are so outclassed athletically?
Well, I don't think you want to deprive the girls of a chance to play at all. So maybe if you could move them into a lower league where they would have a chance to win, obviously through the same competitive rules. But it seems like with regards to the reactions, I read where the Dallas Academy athletic director said that he was proud of the girls for never having quit. It seemed like they weren't happy with the results, but they weren't disappointed in their girls. Everyone kept on trying. But I did see that they're also not going to compete with Covenant anymore. So I guess that takes some of the sting out. So I don't know what the answer is necessarily.
They certainly appeared on one of the morning shows. I think it was ABC, and they were happy about the effort that they put out, and they felt good about themselves in spite of what their parents and their school may have felt about how the whole thing went down. Question, though, for you, Erica, is the coach of the winning team got fired, got thrown under the bus for this. You agree with that?
Absolutely not. I think it was a wrong move by the Covenant School. I just don't think that he needed to be fired. If anything, maybe a suspension, some kind of disciplinary action. But as far as being fired, it was uncalled for.
Well, the argument was that, and I didn't see the game, I've seen clips of it, that they ran the score up in the second half. He said that he took his starters out, but whoever he put in the second half of the game, they were still firing up three balls and still stealing and just running circles around these girls from Dallas Academy.
He still cares about his girls, though. He wants them to perform as best as they could. And, you know, I'm sure he probably didn't, at that moment, didn't think, you know, these Dallas girls are probably going to feel bad at the end of the game. You know, it was just for him, it's more like, you know, these girls have worked hard. So why not, you know, especially if he took the starters out, let the other girls go in and play their game.
Really? What do you say, Jay? What should a coach do in a situation like that? There is no mercy rule in high school athletics.
Yeah, it's a tough call because are you going to put, whether they're your starters or backups, are you going to put your players in and say, okay, just give 50%? I mean, it's definitely a tough call. And the coach even said afterwards, you know, obviously this is not, obviously a result like this shows no compassion, but that's not the case. You know, we feel bad about it. So it was a bit of a role reversal. But in general, I think sometimes if the score gets out of hand, I know when I was on the high school football team, if we were 30-0, 36-0, then we pretty much called off the dogs. So I don't know obviously it's a different sport and different circumstances. So I don't know. Maybe there should be some benchmark, but I would have to agree with Erica. I don't really see why the coach should have been fired in this situation.
Well, this next and last item isn't about mercy, but you could say it's about taste and what some see as the lack of taste by an Arkansas high school girls dance team that performed during a basketball game. A Jonesboro High School team was disbanded. The coach was removed after the team performed a provocative dance at a basketball game. A video showed up on YouTube, where else, called, quote, "The Sluts of Jonesboro," end quote, which displayed the girls' performance in thigh-high stockings, short shorts, and undersized shirts. Provocative, slutty, some pretty harsh descriptions, but I suppose, Erica, anybody that's ever seen a game, professional or high school, where they have these women performing and girls performing have seen this kind of thing before. Do you think this went too far?
Absolutely. At the high school level, it went way too far. I mean, I watched all 6 minutes of the video, and 3 minutes into it, you see the chairs come out and, you know, the lap dancing, you know, starts. That's just too much. And then what they were wearing, would it have made a difference if they were wearing more clothing? I don't know. But, I mean, the lap dancing just went way too far.
Well, I didn't see them do that. I saw the video. They were around the guys. They never really sat on their laps.
Yes.
That would have been completely, clearly over
right.
the line. My question for you, Chad, you would think somebody approves these dance routines before they are presented to the public, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would think so. And everything I've read says that it was approved at the time and that something happened in between the approval or the final practice and when it went on. But that really is no excuse for this.
That's true. Now, Beyonce and others do this sort of thing on TV all the time, and they make millions from it. But Beyonce is an adult artist. Mm-hmm. These are teenagers. Mm-hmm. But is that enough to make a difference?
I think so.
You think so?
I think so.
Yeah? What do you say, Chad?
I would have to agree. I would have to agree.
All right. Before I let you go, one more thing. Your Super Bowl picks, Erica.
Pittsburgh 28-17.
And Chad?
Pittsburgh 31-27.
Okay. So you think it's going to be at least interesting before Pittsburgh walks away with their sixth trophy?
I think it's going to be very interesting. There are a bunch of factors. There are a bunch of factors at play here. And I would, again, I'm picking Pittsburgh. I'm not going to hedge. I wouldn't be surprised if it was the same score the other way around. But I think it's going to be a great game.
I'm pulling for Arizona. I don't know why. I think they're going to lose. I'm just pulling for them just because I'm interested in the storyline of Kurt Warner, for sure. All right. Erica Hernandez is the features editor for Rego Magazine. She joined us here in the studios of NPR West. And Chad Brown writes for alphablogsports.blogspot.com. He joined us from NPR studios in New York City. Thank you both.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. How's it going?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. So it sounds like a lot of listeners chimed in after they heard Tuesday's roundtable that featured two white bloggers talking about race relations in the Obama era.
That's right. Here's a sampling of what they wrote. First off, Ibrahim Siddiq wrote us this on our website. I applaud News and Notes for taking the initiative for this particular program. I also applaud the two guests, both of whom I think addressed a wide spectrum of the impact of the Obama win on race relations in the U.S. The fact that this particular roundtable discussion took place on News and Notes is in itself a testament to the impact of the Obama election and the possibilities for increased healing, not only among blacks and whites, but among all Americans.
C. Epstein wrote us this about the guests Dan Agin and Brandon Perkins. I have to admit that I was a bit uncomfortable and embarrassed to listen to the perspectives of Mr. Perkins in particular, because he did seem to be on the defensive and not even aware of it. I was hoping that black listeners wouldn't ascribe his attitudes to all whites. Thank you, Mr. Agin, for hammering home the non-homogeneity point.
And Justin Strout sent us this. I thought both guests made terrific points. I wish I could have seen this, quote, defensive posturing of Mr. Perkins, but as a fellow white man firmly ensconced in the hip-hop generation, I'm pretty sure that defensiveness came more from the caliber of intellectuals the very young journalist was up against rather than some race discomfort.
This also came into us from James Patton in Brooklyn, New York. I have heard a disappointing number of guests on News and Notes downplay the significance of the Obama presidency. America's societal identity has substantively and demonstrably changed. America is no longer a racist society. Racists still exist, of course, but they are now, by definition and beyond argument, the exception and not the rule. The war is over, and now civil rights activists must radically shift their focus to winning the peace.
And finally, Ruthie Curtis in Marietta, Georgia, wrote us to say she thought the interview you did with football great Jim Brown was one of the best she's heard on NPR. She sent us this. I had followed this legend for a lot of my 55 years in the sports world and into his life after football. Tonight gave me greater insight into this legend and what he truly means to our society. Well, that's it for letters. Please keep your thoughts coming over the next few months.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Sasha, thank you.
No problem, Tony.